who think that talking back there can't be heard up here, you're wrong. Okay. Thank you all very much for being here. I'm going to turn this over to George Cunningham, but George isn't a good yeller. So they always turn it over to me to get it started. Feel free to bring chairs in from outside. Feel free to sit wherever you can find a place to sit. And enjoy.
Thank you, Rick. The reason that we brought Rick onto the board was that we needed an enforcer. And he has fulfilled that role very well. Thank you for getting everything settled here. Well, welcome. Welcome to the Grand Canyon Institute Education Forum. And thank you for taking the time from your busy schedules. We know you have work, and you have commitments in the afternoon, and you've made time to come here. We know you have family and friends that you need to get home to. So we're going to be as brief as possible. But you are privileged to attend or be present for the first inaugural Grand Canyon Institute reception. And before we hear from our guest speaker, Don Buttinger, let me take a few moments to introduce some people and some guests. First, I'd like you all to give a special thanks to Lucia and Wayne Howard for opening up their beautiful home for this event. Thank you so much. I also want to recognize our caterer who has put together this delicious food and all of the other refreshments that are available for us, Salome Schroeder, my gal Sal, and her lesser half, Roland, has also helped as well. We had several legislators who had RSVP'd, but we've learned that the floor in the Senate and the floor in the House have been very busy. And that members are, so many members have not been able to attend. But I want to take a couple of minutes and recognize those who did. But in order to expedite the program, I'm asking that rather than an extended applause for each of those that's recognized, that you just clap once. That you just bang your hands together once. And at first I'll say something like, do it. And you can. And then after a while, when we get the flow going, it'll work for everything. So the first person that I'd like to introduce is a senator from Tucson, Senator David Bradley. Raise your hand. Thank you. Another state senator that's present tonight is Sean Bowie. Thank you. I would also like to recognize those are the only two legislators that I think are in the audience. If there's others, please, someone yell at me, and we'll make sure that they're recognized as well. There are some others, special guests, that I'd like to recognize for their service to the state of Arizona or their intended service. I'd like to recognize the former Secretary of State of the state of Arizona, Betsy Bayless. Betsy, thank you. I'd also like to recognize the former Superintendent of Public Instruction, Carolyn Warner. Carolyn. I'd also like to recognize a candidate who is here with us tonight, a candidate for state treasurer, a statewide office, Mark Manoil. There he is, right there. And I'd also like to recognize a congressional candidate, which we have here tonight, Dr. Hiral Tupernini. That's Congressional District 8. So so those are my introductions of, stars and elected officials and candidates, et cetera. If there are others, we can catch up on them later in the program. I'd also like at this time for each of the members of the Grand Canyon Institute Board to raise their right hand so that everybody will have a chance to see them. They're all around. There's Rick DeVos, Tom Chapman. All right. I'd also like to recognize at this time the Grand Canyon Institute staff, our people. They are very super. In addition to all the other activities that they do, including those involved in research and marketing and communications, they also were instrumental in putting together the organization for this event. And those of you who know about these kinds of events, because you've been in a position where you've had to either organize them or help organize them, you know what kind of work is involved. So I would like to recognize especially Amy Padada. Amy. And I'd like to recognize Max and Dave Wells. They're here. Now let me give a very short advertisement, and then we'll move on with the program to that which you really want to hear about. We have a three-panel brochure of the Grand Canyon Institute for those of you who may not be familiar with the Grand Canyon Institute as a what we consider ourselves to be a centrist think tank. That brochure is on this table here, but there's also some that are spread around. If you have a chance, take a look at it. It is in a very bold, big print, so it's easy to read, and you can get a good sense of what the Grand Canyon Institute is all about. There's also, at the front table where you came in, there's also a document entitled Grand Canyon Institute Impact on Public Policy Initiatives and Decisions, because there's no sense in having a think tank if you just do a bunch of studies and research and then they end up on shelves and they have no impact. They have no impact on public policy initiatives or decisions. And so the document that we put together will show you, if you have a chance to review it, what kind of impact that the Grand Canyon Institute has had over the past 7 years of its existence. And I think you'll be pretty impressed with what we've been able to do on a very low budget. And I think that others have characterized us as the mouse that roared. And I think that's becoming part of our moniker. So with all of that, I want to, at this time, introduce the person who's going to introduce our guest speaker. And she has been a tremendous addition to the board of the Grand Canyon Institute, and she is a very hard worker. And as you know, you're here in your home. So let me turn this over to Lucia Howe.
Thank you. I would like to thank and welcome all of you for being here tonight. This started out as something where we just thought, well, we want to introduce the Grand Canyon Institute and talk a little bit about education, but it's clearly become much more than that. And I want to thank you for being here. And if you ask what's supposed to come out of this evening, nothing but some education and the hope that people from totally different walks of life, totally different perspectives, different political parties, different everything, will get an opportunity to meet each other and talk to each other on an issue we can agree on. We agree that the future of this state is dependent on our kids, not on us. I mean, the average age in this room is probably 80. But there are some huge exceptions, but Wade and I are pushing it towards that end. But there are people in this room also who are parents, who are teachers, who are principals, and they have a lot to educate us about. And I think that until we get educated and until we start talking to our legislators and people who make policy, nothing's going to change. One of the absolute foremost people in that regard, we are happy to have as our guest speaker tonight, and that is Don Budinger. Don Budinger really needs no introduction, but for the two people in the room who may not know everything he's done, I will tell you a little bit about him. Don is the American success story. He and his brother started a company many years ago in their garage. And from that company, it grew to manufacturing finishing chemicals that are basically used on computer chips all over the world. They sold that business in 1999, and they could have lived high off the hog, as, you know, some of us do. But they took their money and put it where they cared. And what they found when they were running their company is that the quality and skill level of the employees with a high school education in Arizona was very, very inconsistent. Sure, we have great students, we have smart students that get great educations, and we have some students that come from inner city schools that get great education, but we have millions of students in the middle who are getting not so great an education. And I think that's what we're all here to talk about tonight. So after selling their company, Don and his brother took a significant portion of the proceeds and set up the Rodell Foundations, of which Don is currently the chairman. Since that time, they have spent over $150 million in researching and implementing strategies to improve K through 12 education in Arizona and in Delaware, which are the two states in which they operated their companies. So, in addition to his commitment to education, Don has led pretty much every major organization in the state, and he has gone from being chairman, trustee, board member, from Phoenix Leadership to Southern Arizona Leadership Council, to the O'Connor Institute, Tucson Value Teachers, ASU trustee. I could go on and on and on, but the real reason he's here today is because he has an experience to share over the last few years of the best and worst of Arizona's education. He is a founder, a co-founder, and on the board of the BASIS Charter Schools, which have been some of the most successful and nationally recognized in the country. But he realizes that everybody cannot go to BASIS schools. So we need to talk about what we have to do to bring that quality of education to every student in Arizona. So with that, it is my pleasure and my honor to introduce Don Budinger.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. I want to thank Lucia and Howard for, and Wayne Howard for this lovely spot. Everybody says, what a great crowd. Well, with that view, how could it not be, right? And also want to thank the Grand Canyon Institute and the board for inviting me for this message. And a thought as we start. You're going to get handed out a four-page document, hopefully. And here's the drill. This is a homework piece. We're going to just discuss this briefly. Please don't turn the page until we do it together. Okay? So is that handed out? Thank you. Okay, so as a matter of introduction, what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes is the state of education funding in Arizona. It is complex, it is complicated. There are very few people who really understand it. There are four or five think tanks who have done a Herculean job. We have talked with all of them. We have dealt with all of them. We have dealt with their data. We have added to their data. The key folks on this piece that you're going to see right now is JLBC, which I would say would be in the center, which is the state's agency in charge of this data. And on the left, ASPO, and on the right, ATRA. So we have a right, a center, and a left provider of this data. And let me just say this about data generally. I think there's a significant growing cynicism in the country about whether data is real or fake, whether facts matter anymore. And I would say this, for sure there's some of that. The people that say facts don't matter, they only want to have their own views reinforced with whatever data they can find. I think on this subject in Arizona of education funding, there is so much data, it's overwhelming. It's confusing. Even reasonable, thoughtful, careful people who try to assemble this have difficulty. What's challenging and what's tonight's message is the fact that you can have this data and you can literally create two opposite narratives of what the data means. We're okay to we're not okay. So if you would just go with me through this, let me just take this a page at a time. A simple way to say this is we have three buckets, three funding sources for Arizona's K-12 system. There's the state, there's the local, and the federal. So let's look quickly at each one. The state budget consists of four basic pieces. The general fund, which are taxes created from all tax sources that the legislature puts into the general fund to fund K-12, it's about 42 or 3% of the total. Then districts who meet the equalization formula add to that. If you're in a wealthy school district, the taxes on your real estate property pay your obligation to meet the equalization formula. The two of those added together, plus two other things that citizens have decided they wanted into this pot. Prop 301, we'll talk about that extension in just a second, the classroom site fund, and then Prop 123. The sum total of those four inputs is $6.9 billion. If you divide that by 1,100,000 kids, you get to a $6,300 per student level of base funding, just the state. Now, here's where it starts to get interesting. So where does that put us? We're somewhere between 46th and 50th, even though every state does this a little differently. The challenge is, if you say 50th, and somebody else has data that we're 47th, they won't listen to you. They'll just put you in the never enough category, and they literally won't hear the rest of your presentation. So we've got to be careful how we use this. But that's the state part. Now, the local part, basically, these are prosperous districts where the citizens in those districts have said, the state doesn't do enough, we want to do more. They voluntarily tax themselves with bonds and overrides. The sum total of that in the year of 2018 was $1.6 billion, and that's about what it's averaged the last 10 years or so. It's a big part of the total. The third bucket is the federal. The federal government funds things that no one else funds. Free and reduced lunch, Title I money, things like that, and that's $1.2 billion, or $1,200 per student. So the sum total is $9.8 billion, or $8,900 per student, assuming that everybody got this. We'll talk about the fact that we don't in just a second. A question now would be, okay, so where does that put us? The average state spends about $12,000 per student. So again, we're on the very low end. Okay, next page, we'll go into some detail. Here are the three buckets with the key components. I'm gonna go through this quickly. This is a little bit down in the weeds. Don't wanna bore you to death with this. But again, the state, the local, and the federal. The basic formula for the state, which includes Prop 123, which is and the additional assistance debit, is $4.1 billion. Now, here's what's interesting. We spent a lot of time with a lot of effort, a lot of money to get 123 passed. $350 million a year, $3.5 billion over 10 years. At the same time we citizens did that, the legislature took back the soft capital, which is called additional assistance, by $352 million. Now nobody knows this. This is how this gets complicated. So if you are a principal or a superintendent, and you've got a broken bus, or you've got a bad air conditioning system, or you need computers or other supplies, and you're trying to figure out your budget for next year, you may not have the capability of giving the teachers an increase. So this is a big deal. Okay, the district share, in other words, the prosperous districts, add another $2.2 billion, and then voter initiatives. These are statewide initiatives where everybody voted and they wanted a few more things into that base funding. Classroom site fund, which is 301, $560 million. Instructional improvement fund, which is a gaming tax, is $45 million. And then three other things. You go to the ballot box every now and then, it says, do you favor the following? You check yes. We have three other funding things. The results-based funding, which comes out of the general fund at $37 million. Full day K is $8 million. Rural assistance, general fund, $2.6 million. The sum total of this is $6.9 billion, or $6,300 per kid. So that's one-third of the three buckets. Local districts, This gets complicated. Bonds pay for physical things. Overrides pay for operating costs, what's called M&O. So the budget overrides for operational needs are $487 million. Capital overrides for capital needs are $84 million. Debt service on the bonds, $718 million. DSEG money, $208 million. Extremely small district, sounds like a funny phrase. That's an adjustment that does not require voter approval, but it's a property tax by the districts. The adjacent ways, which is the real estate next to the school or its pathways, is $24.8 million. The dropout prevention is $5.8 million. Total amount that the districts provide is $1.6 billion. Federal funds, $1.3 billion. Bottom line, we are at the low end of what our fellow citizens around the nation invest in our kids. Now, why we do that, and do we want to continue doing that, that's a whole other subject. I just want to concentrate on the what is for right now. Okay, the next page explains some of that detail and what it means. One example why this is so hard to get your hands around, and I would say this about this all this data. We're not experts. Rodell's worked in this space for 18 years, but we're not experts. But this is probably as good an amateur review as you're going to find, without the background of some bias or some point that the data is designed to prove. But in the case of the two primary data providers, ASBO and ATRA, they use different words to describe the same thing. So for example, the ATRA says that the base formula consists of the general fund plus the district contributions and additional funding by the districts, and the other calls them primary rate funding and the secondary rate funding. So even when you go and you talk to these people and say, I want to understand, just give me the facts, they carry language that you have to then go back to your office and try to figure out what does this really mean. It's really complicated. Okay, districts get money for capital from multiple sources. I'm going to go all through this with you. I'm going to ask you to read this when you get back. But the point of the matter is we basically underfund and stress the system. The school facilities board is supposed to pay for all the schools, but we don't fund it adequately. So part of the bonds and override monies go into repairs of buildings, occasionally all new buildings, but usually repairs of buildings. Now, charter schools, controversial issue. Charter schools get more base funding since they do not have access to bonds and overrides. Now, here's where this gets interesting. If you want to take the case that charters get more, you are right. If you want to make the case charters get less, you're right. So how can that be? The base funding is not spread equally. 15% of our kids are in charter schools. The legislature decided to give the charter schools more base funding because they don't have access to bonds and overrides. So for example, at basis, we get about $800 a kid more than what is given to the traditional public school. However, a significant portion of the public schools have access to bonds and override money. Therefore, we could make the case we get less. We don't get the $8,900, we get the $6,650. But if I'm a school that doesn't have either an override or a bond or federal money, I could be getting as low as $5,000 per kid. So which is it? It's both. It's hard to believe. It's both more and it's both less. It depends upon what lens you look at the issue. Okay, the next page. Here are some commonly asked questions. Why do charters get more funding? I just mentioned that because they do not have access to bonds and overrides, so the legislature arbitrarily gives them more of the base funding. 301, what is the contribution to teacher salaries of Prop 301? A lot of people don't know this. We have the lowest paid teachers in the United States. Think of that. We have the lowest paid teachers in the United States. Okay, of that lowest paid grade, look at the amount that comes from Prop 301. Had 301 not been extended, if for any reason that had failed, we would have a real crisis. Some would say we already do. Okay, I want to talk about 301 for just a second. So here's a good example of the problem. We don't fund adequately from the get-go, so citizens from time to time rise up and say, we want to add to it. So 301, 18 years ago, apparently you know all about this, was added to the mix to increase the funding by about $700 million a year. Okay, the business community wanted to increase 301's funding when it was extended to a penny and a half up from 6 cents. Every tenth of a percent is $100 million. So 2 or 3 tenths increase sounds like a no-brainer. 300 or 400 million in increased funding, we could get our teachers paid to the national average. So it was real easy to sign on for an increase in 301 extension. Well, now you've gone on the legislature and you talk to those folks, and now we're in a different conversation. The risk was the higher the rate was advocated to be increased, the greater the likelihood it would fail. 301 can't fail. So through some back channels, an agreement was made with the governor and the legislature to extend 301 at 6 tenths, to get it in place, do it for the next 20 years, and then we'll work on other ways to get at least another billion. Now, a couple challenges with this. Number one, when 301 was initially voted on, it was a referendum, so that's voter protected. This extension now, after 2021, is not voter protected, which means the legislature can tinker with this. So we've got work to do. We've got to spend more time, quality time, with the people we elect and get on board with this subject. So where we are right now is they've extended it at the 6 tenths. There is a scramble by a lot of people working on this subject to get another billion by other means. Okay, so now this next piece you could spend an hour on, but basically what I want to say here is there are all kinds of special arrangements that have their hand in this pot, and our special needs kids is a good example. Now obviously as a people we want to take care of these kids. The issues they have requires more attention, more diversified instruction, different kind of teaching instruction, and more diversified arrangement of things that these kids need. The autism, Arizona Autism School, for example, gets $25,000 a kid, and they should. But when you do that for part of the system, you're stressing the rest of the system. What about the effects of ESAs and STOs? Everybody know what those are? Anybody not know what those are? Okay. Well, here's an example of how we tinker. So, the scholarships, if you will, for the special needs kids, we administer that through a thing called student tuition organizations, STOs. A certain limited amount of STOs are approved every year. They take a 10% charge for the privilege of distributing the money to the students. We have one organization whose leader is here, who just set a good example of how that's too much and not necessary. Steve Sellers now from the Arizona Community Foundation, his organization charges only 5%, setting a good example. This is a creature of the legislature. If you went down there and went to the committees and listened to how this gets passed, it's a bucket list experience. Okay, ESAs. ESAs were originally intended to give parents the option for their high needs kid to get multiple instruction from multiple places, including private schools. Totally appropriate. Overwhelming approval in the 90% of this polls. The people who advocate for more choice, some of the people who advocate for more choice, want to expand that. So our legislature last May voted to expand ESAs from its original intention to include giving parents a $5,000 voucher to use for a private school tuition. Now this crosses the line for a lot of people. Some people think like that's fine. They think the public school system is broken. Why put more money into a bad system? That whole narrative. And the other side of that is, wait a minute, the public school should be funded by all of us for the public. It's the backbone of the country. It's the single most important asset in our lives. Why would we use public money to pay for a private school tuition? That is the debate. If you want to have an entertaining experience, get into that debate. But that's what we have. And we don't have enough of our citizens enrolled in that conversation to have an impact. I went to the vote last May in the Senate and watched that pass. It was fascinating. The funders of our people were up in the balcony taking a look at how they voted. That whole dark money thing, is, I don't want to get into, but that's another subject. Okay, this last page. Now here's an example. All these numbers I've given you basically are averages, dividing everything by how many kids are in the system. But the system is very complex, very diverse, and very unequally funded. This is the main point. Now here's a sheet from ATRA. These are the folks that are center right. They normally don't like to get into discussions about inequality, but this is their document. So let me just go through this real quickly. So here's two high school districts. And high schools basically get more basic funding in all these categories than the K-8 folks do. So Phoenix Union, thanks to DSEG money, they get $10,365 per student. The average teacher salary is $61,000. Look to the left side. In Tolleson, the funding level is $7,558. Teacher salary is $44,000, closer to the average. 50% difference for two schools 5 miles apart. Look at the number of years that teachers stay in a classroom in Tolleson, 8 years, versus 13 years in Phoenix Union. There's a consequence. I know there's a lot of narrative out there about there's no relationship between funding levels, investment levels, and student achievement outcomes and all that stuff. And again, there's just a tiny bit enough evidence you could make that case. But I think it's a very misleading summary of the condition. There is a relationship between the investment level we make and the outcomes we get. Is there some waste? Is there some excess in some part of the system? Of course. Should we use that to not invest it properly? I would make the case no. So this is just an example of how complex this is. And at the end of the day, we have a system that is underfunded. 1,100,000 kids are in a system that's stressed. Do we have some good examples of wonderful things happening? You bet. If we got some great teachers, you bet. Do we have some wonderful schools? You bet. The NAEP scores are coming out next week. You're going to see, again, wonderful improvement in parts of the system in Arizona, in mathematics and reading. The people who don't want to fund it more are going to say, see, look how wonderful this is. Let me close this part with just one thought. I have a little diagram on my desk, and it shows the funding cuts to K-12 per student since 2008, $1,000 down. It shows the increase during the recovery of about $350 a kid. I could argue two things equally. I could say we're doing great. That $350 per kid actually ranks us for brand new funding pretty high. We have people running for re-election claiming that we are funding an increase at the highest level of anybody in the country. It's technically a true statement, but it's a misleading statement. We have not regained the lost ground. So who leads this conversation? What's the honest way to put this forward? Before we go to questions, I would suggest this for the Grand Canyon Institute. Most think tanks start out with an idea or a point of view or a value or a prejudice or a hypothesis, and they look for data to support it. And there's enough data for almost everything you can support a wide variety of conclusions. If the Grand Canyon Institute set the example in Arizona of not doing that, just go for the data, explain what it means, without prejudice, without bias, without leading the witness, you would make a monstrous contribution to the state of education in Arizona. Because I think when most citizens see this data, they say, hey, maybe we change the conversation. Maybe our taxes aren't a burden we ought to have relief from, maybe they are an investment in our future and an investment for our kids, that we need a balance. We need a balance in a tax rate that's not too high, discourages hard work, saving, and investing, but one that covers our essential obligations. That's not the conversation we have. We get into this too much, not enough, and I think we need to mature past that. Maybe we are the adults in the conversation. So that would be my challenge to the Institute. This is a little primer. Sorry to go through this so fast, it's hard to grab this, but very happy to answer questions. Jackie Norton, who's the CEO of the foundation, would be happy to do this ongoingly, and I see we already have a question. Yes, ma'am. Okay, do you want to ask a question as part of that? Arizona makes the standards. Department of Education, Superintendent of Public Instruction, Carol, you can talk to this quite directly. The school districts create the curriculum to meet the standards. One of the things we have struggled with is the idea of perhaps combining a lot of the districts to save money and increase efficiency. You fly in the face of this notion that this local control is like the Holy Grail. So, but the simple answer to your question is the state's responsible for the standards, and the districts create the curriculum to meet the standards.
But that's not an overall state policy.
Pardon me?
Is that an overall state policy?
That's our state policy.
It's not a state policy.
Carolyn, you want to comment on this? I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but Here's a former superintendent of public instruction when this worked. Any other questions?
Can you repeat part of what Carolyn
said? Yeah, Carolyn, can you? We had a hard time.
Let's see. Is this good there?
No, you don't come out of the thing. Here we go. Thanks. Same thing you just did.
Okay. So there is a State Board of Education. The State Board of Education is appointed by the governor. It has 11 members. They have representatives on the state board from a variety of categories, and the governor appoints within that category. There must be a teacher, there must be a county school superintendent, there must be an administrator, and a variety of other categories, and the governor appoints. They are the people that meet together and set the standards for education in the state of Arizona. They are the ones that are responsible for evaluating as well the adherence to the standards in the state of Arizona. There is also a charter school board, and this charter school board is entirely separate from the State Board of Education, although on the state board there is a charter school member. The charter schools operate on a little different basis. One of the problems that so many people have reference to me is that charter schools are not evaluated in the same way that a local public school is.
Yes, we are. Yeah, we are, Carolyn. We are. At least we are. Let's just go to questions right now, and then we can discuss among ourselves where
okay,
we are.
We just wanted to answer your question fully. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carolyn, sorry to put you on the spot there. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
So I think, you know, we're all here because we value education. I think we're all well aware that Arizona is grossly unfunded by our public schools. So what do we do about it? Like, how do we get more money? I mean, we've seen these propositions passed, and Prop 123 is sort of a joke because it took money out of our state plan trust. How do we actually get money into public, like purely public schools, not charter schools, like public education in the state of Arizona? Like, how do we actually go about creating more funds for Arizona public schools?
Let me comment on two things. First of all, charter schools are public schools.
Okay.
Let's talk about the state land trust. Here's a very challenging example of how tough this is. So the state land trust is a vehicle that was given to Arizona when we became a state in 1912. The federal government gave us 10 million acres and told us to do the best that we could. The sale and lease of those 10 million acres is to go to public education. 100 and some years later, we have 9 million of those 10 million left. Now, here's what we did. Some years, we didn't make any payment to K-12 from the sale and lease of those lands, such that over time, we created a $5 billion cash surplus in addition to the 9 million acres, which is the formal corpus. So what 123 did was it took some of that money that was at the $5 billion and committed it to meet the obligation of Prop 123 and some from the general fund. So you could make the case the whole $5 billion should have been paid, and you still don't interfere with the corpus. Now, I don't think that's prudent, but you could make that case. For sure, the 7 or 8% funding rate that's coming out of that for 5 years is, I would say, is appropriate, given that the money exists because of underspending in the first place. Yes, sir.
I wonder if you know how many associations or groups have exercised their civic responsibilities in an organization to change case, I'm talking about education, which is crucial.
Okay. His question is, how many organizations are there working with people running for office or already in office to make the case to do a better job in funding education? Is that your question? That's one question. Okay. That's a good question. This is one of them.
Because I believe that we will not change until there is a conjunction of fact-based, pragmatic policy coupled with electoral
The question is, what's our role as citizens to influence the people that we elect to do more of what we want? The good news is, this is election year. They return your phone call. They ask for a check. It's time to have a new conversation. Better perfect timing. Yes, ma'am. Initial Prop 305, which is going to do away with the vote that the legislature had last May to include private school tuition as part of the use of the voucher, and it's going to go to the citizens for votes, pass the legal test, so we're going to have that play out in the campaign. That'll be very interesting, to say the least.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Everybody in this room wants to leave and do something.
I think everybody in this room... Well, I won't get into that. But could you tell us one or two things that every single person in the room could go home and do tonight or tomorrow or the next day that would help tell the legislators that we want education funded in Arizona?
Here's the good news. As you all know, we have a Senate and a House, and unlike many states, those two houses are up for election every 2 years. So every single one of them is up for election right now, and all of our top five state offices are up for election. Governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, Superintendent of Public Instruction, and Treasurer. Have a conversation. Invite them to your house. I would show them this document and say, what do you think of this? Get into a different conversation, I think, is the answer to the citizen response generally and maybe after tonight.
All right.
One more question. Yes, sir.
I think the big clarification needs to be is when we talk about public schools, what are we talking about? Because again, I'm here now, Libet, public schools, charter schools. Charter schools, we said, are public schools. It's just a different way that they're funded. The other thing that was not addressed is what happened with the federal funding this year and where the money's flowing from the Arizona Department of Education. It is now fourth quarter, and there are still schools that are Title I schools that have not received their Title I funding. And this is for our low-income students. There are schools that were short funded up to six figures, and most of them were charter schools. They were short funded up to six figures in Title I funding and special education funding. So we're all looking at the governor, we're all looking at the legislature, but if you really want to put on a focus, a target on something, it's the Department of Education, how the money's flowing. When our state superintendent got confronted with that, she went like this, don't blame me, that wasn't my administration, it happened under her watch. And it's still happening. So if our schools are not getting the money, it's mostly because, it's not because of just what the governor and the legislature are doing, but how the money's flowing to the Department of Education. And I would challenge everyone here to go to Diane Douglas and her crew and say, where's the money? And show me the money.
Good idea. All right. Okay, thank you.
I think we should take a moment. We should take a moment to thank our guest speaker for giving us a course in Arizona K-12 Education Funding 101. And that all of us can benefit from that. And there is something that I wanted to mention in addition, and that is that there's some latecomer legislators that have shown up, and they missed the period of time when we would introduce them. I recognize some of them. I probably don't have all of them, but I understand that Representative Mitzi Epstein is here. I believe that Representative Kirsten Engel is here. Raise your hand. Representative Hernandez from Tucson is here. And I understand that the Speaker of the House of Representatives is here, Speaker Mesnard. Thank you for coming. And one other person who's arrived that should be recognized is... Representative Tony Navarrete, welcome. I'd like to also introduce David Shapira. Shapira is candidate for Superintendent of Public Instruction in Arizona. He's in the back. And we have a special presentation to our guest speaker because he did such a fantastic job in reducing our ignorance about the financing and funding of public schools. So, Don, would you please step forward? And I believe that if you remove that particular item, you will find it is of a special affinity to you. All right, it's his favorite wine. We cheated and talked to his assistant. You know, what else? Thank you. Just again, I wanted to thank all of you for coming and joining us tonight. And we've tried to keep the program short. We've tried to give you good food. And I want to turn over the microphone to Rick DeGraw, our treasurer, because he is responsible for ensuring that the Grand Canyon Institute's income minus expense is either positive or zero. And he'll want to solicit your assistance in that regard.
Thank you, George. Okay, so you know an issue is complicated when the speaker has to give you a 5-page handout with detail on it so you can follow the issue. It doesn't have to be that complicated. Charter schools, for the most part, are public schools. Charter schools are part of our public system. But they're treated differently in a variety of ways. But charter schools and public schools are only one issue that the Grand Canyon Institute has dealt with. And what we try to do is present both sides of issues in the materials that we put forth. We do make conclusions, we do suggest some actions, but we did work on the minimum wage increases in Arizona. And there were people who disagreed with minimum wage increases and people who supported it. We put out a paper that I believe was used widely in support of the impact of minimum wages in Arizona. We did the same thing with kids care funding. We did the same thing with Medicaid expansion several years ago. The Grand Canyon Institute is not pro-public or pro-charter. It's not anti-charter. The fact of the matter is, the facts are complicated. And it takes a lot to get through those facts to make sense out of it so people can decide where they stand and what they want to do. We have incredibly dedicated researchers. No one questions their intelligence, their integrity, or their research capability. This institute was begun by George Cunningham. Now, he was only 12 when this 100-year-old institute came about. But I've known George since 1972. And while asking him a question can take 15 minutes to get an answer, you always know that George is going to look under every rock and every look in every nook and cranny to get the proper answer. And that's what the Grand Canyon Institute is all about. And we have to fund it. We have to raise money. We have, tonight, $8,000 that's been given by various individuals for matches. So if you were to donate tonight, your money will be doubled. $8,000, we would love to be able to match all of that $8,000. And because you're stuck here in this eagle's nest until the bus until the bus gets here and we can squeeze you on, and having just gotten back from China, I know what pushers are to get people onto subways and rail lines, so, but out at the table, there's going to be four people that can take credit cards. There's envelopes that can take checks. There's a box sitting by the front door that can take cash. And we'll also take handwritten IOUs and track you down later. But we need your help. We need money to keep this institute running. And whether you agree with everything that is examined or not, that's not the issue. The issue is to give you facts, to put it in front of you and the public so that the proper decisions can be made. There are people that will make look at those facts and make one decision one way and another will make a different decision. That's fine. That's the purpose of good research. We do not begin a project deciding what the outcome is going to be. We begin a project understanding that there's a problem and there's facts and figures related to that problem that need to be mixed through to come up with some coherent end. That's what the Grand Canyon Institute is all about. Now you notice this house is for sale out here? We were thinking of buying it as an institute just to have a place that had a view that people would want to come to. But first, we have to pay our annual expenses. And that's what we're asking you to help us support. Feel free to donate. Feel free to stay around and ask questions. There are board members here. Our researchers are here. Take them in a corner and beat the hell out of them. Whatever you wish to do is fine with us. Right, David? You're up for that.
I just did a marathon.
Okay.
I can run away.
But anyway, I want to thank you for being here. I want to ask for your assistance. We want to make this at least an annual, if not a semi-annual event, where we bring in somebody to talk about an issue that is incredibly complicated and that affects every single one of us. Kids in school or not, our education system affects you. So please help us out. Feel free to ask questions. Feel free to donate. And we'll be ordering the buses up in a few
minutes. Lots of food.
Oh, lots of food and lots of drink. So since you're not driving, at least to your car, drink whatever you'd like. Thank you very much and good night.
Yeah.
I'm exactly.